Ditin, Perikei, Mishnah, 5-5. And the Mishnah continues with various takanos b'pei tikkun olam, but this Mishnah is a little more involved than that. It's actually a Mishnah that is re-quoted, reprinted here from the Mishnah Maseches Edios. In Maseches Edios, we have a collection of testimonies, that's what Edios means, and they came from various Tanaim about what happened Ba'oso Yom on that day, that great day when they opened the doors of the Beis HaMidrash. They sort of essentially, the Talmid Chacham had essentially deposed Rabban Gamliel for how he treated Rabbi Yeshua, and they put Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah to be the Nasi. On that day they opened the doors up and people were invited to come in from all over, and various people at different traditions would report those traditions, and they're collected in Maseches Edios. So that's reprinted here. And therefore we actually have four different topics covered in this Mishnah. The latter two are Takanos. So here it says, Heid Rabbi Yochanan ben Gurgada. These were the four items about which Rabbi Yochanan ben Gurgada attested. He's also a Tana. The Mishnah talks about how he was especially, in Chagiga, he was especially strict that he even ate his chulin b'tahara. And it also, the Tosefta says he was involved in working the Beis HaMikdash, closing the doors. So he gave the following four different testimony regarding four different items, okay? So item number one regards the chareshet. The chareshet is a female cheresh, meaning a deaf mute. And interestingly, by the way, the Tosefta in Trumos says that Rabbi Yochanan Gugna's children were deaf mutes. In any case, so he says regarding a deaf mute that he has a tradition, Shehisiya Avia, that her father is able to marry her off. Interestingly, because she's a deaf mute, she lacks da'as, and therefore she can't enter into any, you know, legally binding transactions, including accepting kedushin. So a deaf mute can't get married on her own, but while a girl is 12 and a half years old or younger, her father can accept kedushin on her behalf, and that's what we're talking about over here, that her father accepts kedushin on her behalf, now marrying the deaf mute off to be a wife. So he points out here, as his like chiddush is, she yotza veget, even though she lacks the requisite da'as, mental capacities, to on her own enter herself into a marriage, but she has enough mental capacities to receive a get, because a get can be received by a woman bal karcha against her will, which means we don't need to have her das. She doesn't need to be consensual. She doesn't have to really understand, you know, to consent to the full, if you will, you know, undoing of the transaction. That is the severance that a get effects. All that the mental capacity that a woman needs to have to effectively receive a get is she has to understand that this is krisus, that this is, the marriage is over, and she shouldn't go back. She shouldn't go back to her husband. That's like called a choseres, a woman who's like, she goes back again and again after she's Michelle Chava Choseres, she's sent away, but she goes back again. And the assumption is that a woman who's a deaf mute has the requisite mental capacity to understand she's been sent away and not to go back, so she can be divorced. Okay, that's the first of his four testimonies. No other connection really to our topic here. It is mentioned, it's Mesechus Gittin, this is about a get, but I think that's just totally coincidental. Now, part two of our Mishnah, the second of the four items which he testifies, actually has a 2a and 2b. So part two is about a girl who was married off by her mother or brother. So the case is that if a girl, like I said before, could get married off by her father, that would be a doraisa marriage. He can accept kedushin on her behalf so long as she's just, you know, a katan or even a nara, 12 and a half or younger. But if she's orphaned, meaning her father's no longer alive, so the rabbis instituted that her mother or her bar mitzvah brother could marry her off, and then she'll be married rabbinically. And the thought is that that is really to be a benefit for her, so she's not roaming the streets, and she's protected and lives a proper life. So that's for her interest. So the truth is that such a girl, if she wanted to, could reject that husband and not be married to him. And if, even in fact, if she is married to him, like rabbinically, if later on before her bat mitzvah she decides she doesn't like him after all, she can be, she can do miyun, she can like reject him and be like essentially retroactively never married, meaning she could marry Cohen after that even. So we're talking about such a case. So she's therefore kind of rabbinically married. Now, if the girl's parents were not, her father was not a Kohen, so she is not a Koheness. She can't eat Truma. A woman who marries a Kohen is part of his household. There's like a Kenyan there, and the Pasuk specifies that with a Kenyan Nefesh of a Kohen, his household, meaning his wife or even his slaves, can, yes, eat Truma. So this woman is being, this girl is being treated as his wife, and therefore the Mishnah here is going to say that there's, in some limited capacity, she can eat Truma, even though the truth is that really Midoraisa, they're not married. This marriage is like a imaginary marriage sanctioned by the rabbis, but they're not married. So therefore Midoraisa, she can't eat Truma, but she could eat Truma rabbinically, meaning rabbinic Truma. And that's the first, you know, 2a of innovation of the Mishnah here. It says inside, Va'al Katana Bas Yisrael, he also testified regarding a girl who's a minor, whose father is not a Kohen, he's Yisrael, Shenisses the Kohen, who marries a Kohen, because, meaning again, this is rabbinically married by her mother or her brother, She'ochelas v'truma, that she's permitted to eat Truma. Now, since she's only rabbinically married, if you will, so she only can eat rabbinic Truma. But that can happen in lots of ways, meaning she can't eat Truma d'oraisa because she's not really married to a Kohen mid'oraisa. But according to most Rishonim, only Dagan, Tirsh, and Yitzhar, grain, wine, and olive oil are obligated in Trumos mid'oraisa. Other ones only mid'orabanan. So that according to those shitas, you know, let's call it rice or apples, those you take Trumos amaisa, but that's rabbinic in nature, and therefore so she can eat those kind of foods. According to the Rambam, who I think is the more like famous shita, because the Rambam is the Rambam, he holds that essentially all agricultural produce, except for vegetables, are obligated mid'oraisa in Trumos amaisras. So according to the Rambam, would be another scenario where it's only rabbinic in nature. Like, for example, if the stuff grew in a, you know, in a atzach enonako, like a flower pot that doesn't have perforated holes, it's only rabbinically required, and so on. Whatever the case is, the point is, she's allowed to eat truma, that's truma midrabanan. And the chiddush is that you might have thought if she's eating, you know, the truma rice and apples in the house, she'll soon eat the truma grapes and wheat, and the grapes and wheat are actually, you know, truma midoraisa, perhaps. So aren't we afraid of that? The point is that we're not afraid of that, and that's the chiddush here. And although that seems very sort of un-rabbinic, usually the rabbis, of course, are afraid of easy mix-ups that will lead to an isra d'oraisa. Here, we're not afraid of that because she's a minor anyway. So our worst-case scenario is that a girl who's not bas mitzvah eats truma, which, well, you can't do the lachachila, but you have it since she's a minor, it's not nevera. Okay, fine. That was 2a. Now 2b, another din regarding the girl who's married off by her brother or her mother rabbinically, that the imesa ba'ala yorsha, if she dies, her husband, like her rabbinic husband, because Midrash is not married, but her rabbinic husband is the one who inherits her. The point here is that the Yerusha is a din d'oraisa. Normally a girl who's not married, and this girl isn't married to Midrash, when she dies, it's her father. If there's no father, then let's say her brother would inherit her. So here the rabbi is saying, even though really Midrash, her brother should inherit her, but Midrabanan, we're letting her husband marry her. And that's just because they're living as a husband and wife. We're treating like a husband, so he gets to inherit her like a husband would inherit his wife normally. If you'll ask, wait a second, if Yerush is a din d'oraisa, how can the rabbis undermine that? The answer is the rabbis have a power of hefker, bez, and hefker. They can always render someone's property ownerless, and then sort of reassign it wherever they want, and that's what's happening over here. They essentially effectively are rendering her estate that she leaves behind ownerless, and then giving it to her surviving husband. Okay, that was the second thing. Now, again, no mention of here of takanos, nothing to do with gittin at all. Now, point 3 and 4 are takanos. That's what they're mentioned here, presumably. So, the third thing that he testified about was val hamarish hagazul, on a beam that's been stolen, shebana'o bebira, that the thief builds that stolen beam into his like large home, whatever it is, sheyitol es damav, that he is allowed to, that the victim, the nigzal, the person from whom he stole it, should accept cash in lieu of the actual beam. They takanas hashavim, because of a tikkun called takanas hashavim, a tikkun for the sake of penitence, so people can do tshuva. So here's just the bigger picture here. The Torah has a mitzvah all to itself. Besides for the lo sigzol, you're not allowed to steal. That's a mitzvah to itself. And when a person steals, he's violated that. So he became a thief, and now he's got to do tshuva. It happens to be that when it comes to gezela, there's also another mitzvah, which is the requirement of veheshev esa gezela asher gazal. He has to return anything that was stolen. So if a person steals, if I steal your tennis shoes from your closet, I have to, if the tennis shoes are still extant, they still are around, so I'm required to return them to you. I can't just give you the value of the tennis shoes. I have to give you those very tennis shoes. I can't give you new tennis shoes. I have to give you the very tennis shoes that I took from you if they're around. If they're no longer around, like I lost them or something, you know, my dog ate them, so then I have to give you the value of what I took from you. That's a separate din all to itself. So, while you may know that if there was a shinui, like a relevant change to the stolen item, so it now has a different name, shinui Hashem, or shinui maisa, it's been transformed to something else entirely, so then there's the mitzvah of the thief acquires the stolen object, which has been transformed, and he has to just give back now value instead. That's not the case of our Mishnah. The case of our Mishnah is you took a beam and you stuck it in the, as like a support of a house, so the beam is still the beam, and therefore, technically speaking, the thief who stole the beam has to return the very beam that he stole. But the rabbis realize people won't come to do tshuva if it's going to cost them dismantling their house. And therefore they made this din derabanan, which is in situations like this, this is a general principle, not just one particular application, of not just one a specific rule to beams, but in general, when returning a stolen object will cause a person significant, you know, harm or inconvenience or expense, which would then inhibit him from returning the actual object and doing tshuva. So the rabbis institute in such a situation that the thief can do tshuva by giving back value instead of the value of the stolen object and not giving back the object itself. So just to make sure this is clear here. The point here, this is takanas hashavim. We're trying to do a tikkun here to allow people to become penitent, meaning to do tshuva and stop being thieves. So just like, you know, when if a person eats bacon, so he's on nevera, he has to do tshuva, so stop being a bacon eater, and there's no requirement for him to like regurgitate out what he ate. He just has to do tshuva, not do it again, whatever tshuva involves. So too, a person who's contravened the isser of stealing has to stop being a thief and do tshuva. It doesn't require him to, so to speak, regurgitate what he stole to do tshuva. Okay? There happens to be a separate din all to itself. If one has the object, he has to return it, or if he hasn't, he has to give value back. That's a separate mitzvah. Okay, we're not focused on that really. And although there's a requirement when you do tshuva to if you are going to repent on a matter that's been on the chavero between interpersonal matter between you and a fellow Jew, so you have to at all events be meratza. You have to appease your victim. Here we're saying you can appease your victim with the value, not give the actual beam or whatever that you stole back. Because you want people to do tshuva and stop being thieves. And the rabbis are giving you a pass with respect to returning the actual thing you stole, allowing instead to give value in its place, so people will be encouraged to do tshuva and stop being thieves, etc., which is, in the rabbis' minds, more important than the victim getting his very beam back. If you'll ask the question, the very legitimate question, wait a second, the Torah says you have to give the beam back, so how can the rabbis say you can't? You don't need to, I should say. So the answer is, just like the rabbis have the power of hefker, bez, and hefker, which they use sometimes, which might even be in play over here, as far as the requirement to return heshev as a gazelle, the very stolen object, there the rabbis have the power which of saying that you can do bishev altasa, you can just sit in your hands and not carry out a mitzvah d'oraisa. And that would be, like the Rambam learns fascinatingly, that the mitzvah to return the stolen object is one mitzvah, and the mitzvah to return the value, the value of the stolen object, if you can't do the object itself, is a separate mitzvah. So the rabbis are saying, okay, the object's around, but we're giving you a pass to not return that object, because they're telling you to sit in your hands and do nothing, like Sheva Al Tase, kind of like the rabbis say, you know, we're not going to blow a shofar on the first day of, on Rosh Hashanah, if it falls on a Shabbos, for whatever reasons, even though the Torah says you will, but the rabbi says, no, we're not going to. And they can do that. It's not telling them to do an avera, it's saying they're telling you not to do a specific mitzvah, to be passive and do nothing at all. Okay, so that was point number three, the takana of takana sashavim, so people could do tshuva, make it easier on them to do tshuva from being thieves by returning value instead of the actual object, in the event that it would be very difficult for them to give the object itself back. And finally, number four, valchata sagazula, if a person stole an animal which is being brought as a chatas. We're talking here about a sheep. And this female sheep that you're supposed, or yeah, that's supposed to be given, if you stole it, so then it's not yours to consecrate, to make it into a chatas. So that means when you offered, it's not really your offering, and really you're not getting an atonement. But they made a dinder abanan, provided that shlo noda l'rabim, assuming that it's not a publicly known fact that this is a stolen sheep. What does that mean? So there's two shitas. Either it means that three people don't know about it, or like it's not a generally widely known thing. That shehi mechaperes, that this, the bringing of this offering, even though it wasn't yours, is mechaperes. Now the one pshat here, my preferred pshat, it's like the Rashba Tiferes Yisrael, is that what they did is the rabbi said, although it's not yours, and therefore you really shouldn't be able to attain atonement with it, they are using the power of Hefker, Bez, and Hefker all over again. They're making an owner list, letting you, the thief, acquire it, and therefore when you consecrate it and bring it as a chatas, it actually is your animal for being a chatas. That doesn't mean you don't have to repay the what you stole. That's a separate point. But our point is here, the animal is yours, and actually it achieves atonement for you. Not everyone agrees with that. Many learn that it doesn't actually do anything for you. It just doesn't require you to do it a second time. But let's learn even that it is, as the Mishnah says, it is effective getting you a kapara. Why would they do that? Because mipnei tikkun ha-mizbeach, they want to make sure that the mizbeach, the altar, functions properly. The concern is like this. If the Kohanim were afraid that people who look a little shady and brought, you know, achatas to be brought on their behalf, if the Kohanim are suspicious that maybe this is a stolen sheep, so then the problem is, they're going to say, listen, once we offer this thing, we'll have to eat the meat, and we don't want to eat the meat of a non-consecrated animal, which we shechted in the Azara and wasn't a valid korban, and we eat it. That's an isser. You're not allowed to do that. It's super, super not kosher. That's an isser. It's a karas involved here. So we don't want to do that. So therefore, they're just not going to eat, and therefore, they're not going to offer them as offerings, and therefore, the whole, you know, enterprise of the base English and like the offerings of Mizbeach and the Kohanim's relationship to the people all could come to a nasty grinding halt. So the rabbi said, no, we're not doing that. We're not letting that happen. We're going to say, listen, every Kohen can totally trust whatever sheep they're bringing as a chatas because the rabbis are saying it's effective and therefore it's kosher and good. And therefore the things will function as they ought to function in terms of no hesitation on the behalf of the Kohanim. This is because the Kohanim don't want to eat, I'll call it treif. That being the case, it's got through the chatas. But let's say, for example, an ola is a burnt offering that the Kohanim don't eat any of it. So there, the rabbis didn't see any reason to make any such tikkun, takana. And therefore, if a person steals an animal or even buys an animal that he knows is stolen and brings it as an ola, he won't be yotzi. Okay, it's just for chatas because the case of tikkun mizbeach. And then again, that this final case here, the fourth case, is the second example in our Mishnah of a takana, analogous like Tikkun Olam, and that's why it's included here in our Mishnah.